O death, O death, won't you spare me over till another year? Those words ring in my ear when I think about the men and women on death row. This is a complicated sermon. It's a complicated issue. It's multifaceted. And Alan, I thank you for sharing. I thank you for reminding us of those who serve in all facets of the justice system, and it's hard work. And it takes a lot out of you. And I've seen that firsthand. And as a teenager, like most teenagers do, most liberal teenagers, I had a collection of catchy activist bumper stickers hanging on my wall. And one of them read, "Why do we kill people who kill people to show that killing people is wrong?" I'd always held the belief that capital punishment was a moral issue, but I'd never thought about it in terms of justice, compassion, or mercy. That was not the world in which I grew up. From 1976 to 2015, 1,392 executions occurred in the United States. 995 of them took place in the South. A mere 2% of our nation's counties have produced both a majority of all executions imposed since 1976 and prisoners awaiting execution. Highlighting the somewhat arbitrary and unequal nature of our death penalty system. The U.S. has the highest incarceration rate in the world. Today, there are 2.3 million incarcerated people in our country, nearly quadruple the number in 1980. And over 76% of murder victims in cases resulting in execution since 1976 were white. Even though nationally, about 50% of murder victims are black. One in six black men has been incarcerated as of 2001, and if current trends continue, one in three black males born today can expect to spend some time in prison during his lifetime. In Alabama, a black man was arrested and charged with the murder of a white woman, a dry cleaning clerk. There was no physical evidence, only testimony from three others who were known criminals. And the testimony was the result of coercion by the sheriff, known for his racist views. The community was in such an uproar that the defense attorneys filed for a change of venue out of that particular county. And the judge chose a nearby county that was largely white and wealthy. And the jury was all white. The defendant had a solid alibi. Multiple witnesses testified to his presence at a neighborhood fish fry near his house. All the witnesses were black. The trial, a murder trial, only took a day and a half. And in the end, the judge overruled the jury's sentence of life without parole and instead sentenced the man to death. And this case didn't happen in the Jim Crow South of the 50s and 60s. It happened in the late 80s. It was one of Bryan Stevenson's cases. Scholar and author Michelle Alexander notes that our contemporary system of incarceration, she describes it as the new Jim Crow. And she writes this: "Arguably, the most important parallel between mass incarceration and Jim Crow is that both have served to define the meaning and significance of race in America. Indeed, a primary function of any racial caste system is to define the meaning of race in its time. Slavery defined what it meant to be black, a slave. And Jim Crow defined what it meant to be black, a second-class citizen. Today, mass incarceration defines the meaning of blackness in America. Black people, especially black men, are criminals. This is what it means to be black." This trend, this outcome of systemic oppression in many forms over time, is one of the many reasons why we must say Black Lives Matter. And yes, it is more than Black lives. And the criminal justice system in this country is distorted by both race and poverty. It's shaped by wealth over culpability. In some cases where poor defendants are convicted or are charged with non-criminal offenses, non-violent offenses, they are approved for diversion programs, which will keep them out of jail and without a conviction on their record, and they must first post bond. But so many of those families experiencing poverty cannot even come up with the money to post bond, let alone afford any monthly payments. So their family member has no choice but to accept and serve out the jail time and have the conviction on its his or her record. And yet we know that systemic racism in this country has led to the extreme poverty and disenfranchisement of so many people, that the two are deeply intertwined. In poor communities and communities of color, there is deep despair, a hopelessness that is being shaped by the outcomes of a broken system. This past Thursday, some of you joined us for that film screening of Gideon's Army, which looked at the public defender system, highlighting its challenges. And we were joined by an ACLU staff member, this month's plate partner, and as I watched the film, I was stunned by how blinded I felt like I had been by an optimistic and naive notion of our justice system and how it works. I believe that many people in this country still believe in the ideals of the system that we learned about as young people, that all people are innocent until proven guilty, that all are entitled to a fair and speedy trial with a jury of your peers. But that didn't happen for the man in Alabama. That all are entitled to legal representation, even if you cannot afford it. And of course, I assume these attorneys committed themselves to offering the very best legal counsel they could, because that is part of the oath they took. That there are good people and bad people. Do the crime, do the time. Actions have consequences. End of story. That's the vision of the world in which I grew up. And to preach this sermon and dive into this issue still leaves me a little conflicted. And so I offer you these words for your own reflection and for our collective reflection. Because as many of you know, I was raised by my mother, who spent my entire life in the county prosecutor's office. And today she is the elected county attorney in Pima County, Arizona. So I grew up in a world where criminals were criminals. And if their cases went to trial, it was most certainly because there was overwhelming evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant was guilty of the alleged crime, period. End of story. In my childhood worldview, public defenders were something of the enemy, using their bag of tricks to keep bad guys from going to prison or to get them lighter sentences. I grew up in the courtroom. I spent my summers in the courtroom. One summer, a defense attorney filed for a mistrial, complaining my presence in the courtroom was unduly influencing the jury on the prosecution's behalf. Needless to say, I didn't get to come back to that courtroom that summer. But in this growing up, in this worldview, what I did not see was how our defense attorneys, our public defenders, have unimaginable caseloads. Hundreds of active cases at one time. How can any attorney, no matter how good, keep track of all their clients, let alone offer the very best legal defense they are capable of under such circumstances? What I did not see was the impact of mandatory sentences, that a 17-year-old's life could be changed forever, charged with armed robbery, facing a 10-year mandatory minimum and a maximum of life without parole. The U.S. is the only country in the world where we can sentence 13-year-old children to life without the possibility of parole, to die in prison. What I did not see was a system defined by error, where 146 death row prisoners have been exonerated since 1976, and many more have been resentenced to life in prison due to legal errors. What I did not see were people's stories, hard life stories of neglect and abuse and pain and brokenness. Stories that led them down a path that many of us just cannot imagine. And yet, these are the very things we must see. We must look into the face of the other and notice the brokenness so that we might unlock the compassion and offer some mercy. It's easy to say, let the justice system work. We have a good system built on good ideals. Let it do its work. The scales of Lady Justice are balanced. But when we take the blindfold off, we see the scales are not always balanced. We see that an equal system is not always a just system. That giving everyone the same size block to stand on doesn't mean they'll be able to reach the fruit. And this is hard to do when we're talking about crimes against people. People do some horrible things. And some people are just evil. And when you grow up a prosecutor's child, you hear too many stories of the horrible, evil things people do. Or if you've been a victim of crime, you've experienced the horrible, evil things that people do, and it colors the way you see the world. We live in a world with a justice system that likes neat boxes and categories and wants to assume that everyone can fit neatly within those boxes and categories. There isn't always room to see the story of the Iraq War veteran with such severe PTSD that he murdered the man who was with a woman he was in love with because he thought he was hurting her. Often we only see the crime, and we don't stop to ask ourselves, how have we as a society failed this veteran who served on the front lines of combat? When we as a society paint any one group with a broad brush, we compromise our humanity. We fail to leave room for the stories and circumstances unique to each individual. We fail to leave room for compassion and mercy. And we see this happen all the time, especially in these recent weeks. Society draws a circle and then stands outside of it and points and says the word, those people, those criminals, those homeless, those refugees, those terrorists, those Muslims. And yes, even those politicians and those gun nuts and those pro-lifers, those people. And to hear it and to say it too is painful. The pain of these last weeks has been as much about the tragedy and violence as it has been about the vitriol and the rhetoric. Where's the we in those people? Where is the us? We are the stone catchers. In Bryan Stevenson's book, he tells the story of meeting an older black woman in court after a hard-won victory. He recalls seeing her in the courtroom over the course of the trial nearly every day and assumed that she was related or connected to one of their clients, but they'd never met. And after the courtroom had cleared out, she called him over to give him a hug. And he learned that she was not a relative, nor was she connected to the clients in any way. But she came to help the people in this place where she saw so much pain. She proceeded to tell him that 15 years earlier, her 16-year-old grandson was murdered by other boys, and that she came to the trial every day for weeks, grieving and crying. In the end, the boys were found guilty and sent to prison for life. And she confessed that she thought that would make her feel better, but it didn't. And after a year of feeling lost, she began to come back to this courthouse to be a presence, to be someone people could lean on. She noticed that some of the ones grieving the most were the parents and family members of the people on trial. She started letting anyone who needed to lean on her, cry on her shoulder. Amidst the grief and the violence and the locking up of human life and the hurting of one another, she saw herself as someone who was supposed to catch the stones we cast at one another. And Brian Stevenson reflects on the story from the Christian scriptures of the woman about to be stoned to death for committing adultery. And Jesus says to the crowd, "Let the one who is without sin cast the first stone." Today, far too many stones are being cast at people out of fear and righteousness, out of hatred and ignorance. Even people who profess to be religious people, pious people whose faiths teach compassion are casting so many stones. We have to be the stone catchers. Sometimes that is what is needed. We cannot all be the Brian Stevensons of the world fighting in court, but we can be the stone catchers, bearing witness, offering presence, attending the vigils and protests, writing letters, educating our children, raising our voices to shine a light on injustice in all of its interconnected forms. Like the woman in the courtroom, even in our despair, we can catch the stones. May it be so. Amen. Let us be together in a moment of silence.